Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. Today on Midnight in Karachi, I'm joined by Adam Roberts, novelist, critic, teacher, and the man behind a number of pseudonyms and a couple of dozen novels. He's been nominated for the Clark Award 3 times, and he has won both the BSFA Award and the Campbell Memorial Award as well. His most recent novel is Bet, a scary, funny, and oh-so-smart story about a world where animals have attained increased intelligence and are happy to discuss your right to murder them with you. Adam, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on.
It's been a long time since I've been wanting to interview you, so I'm thrilled that you're finally here.
I'm delighted.
You recently did a best of 2014 list. It was 6 of your own books, which was, you know, a hilarious take on what everyone else, including me, was doing. The obvious question...
Yeah, and self-regarding as well.
Yes.
I'm glorious. I shocked myself with how pride, my own pride in my output. It's ridiculous, really. Many books. 6 books is too many books. We can agree on that.
Well, it's always good to surprise yourself, you know.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Well, the obvious question, of course, is did you really write 6 books in a year? But since I know that you didn't write them, though you are very prolific, how about you just tell me how many books you're going to write this year?
Okay, well, as you say, I didn't write any of these books. What I do is there's a young boy in Indonesia, and he writes all my books for me. I then buy them from him and pass them off as my own work. I pay him the minimum wage, so he's all right, and I get all the glory and the awards and everything. So it's win-win, really. So this year I've commissioned from him to write. Actually, how many books am I writing this year? You've asked me a good question there.
Are you writing off an email to him really quickly to check?
Just desperately finding out what he's doing. My main publisher is Galance, Victor Galance, which are part of Orion Books, and I have a contract with them. So I usually have a novel out with Galance once a year. So I'm just finishing up now, this month, as we speak. Not as we actually literally speak, but just before we started speaking, and I shall pick it up again when we stop speaking. I'm just finishing up that novel, which at the moment is going to be called The Thing Itself. I don't know. I'm still debating whether that's a good title or not. So that, I think, is coming out at the end of this year. So I'll have that one. And I might have a collection of short stories from a small press. So that's only 2. Oh, and I might have a third project with Jurassic. So that's 3.
That's not so many. That's only half. Yes. Half as many as last year.
Exactly. 3 this year. Next year, I'll just do 1.5. And that way, eventually, I'll run out of books altogether.
So you're slacking this year, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm tired. When you get to my age and you just want to sit back and watch the cricket, it's very hard.
You could hire another boy in Indonesia.
pay my second boy the minimum wage as well. That's double the minimum wage.
Yes, I know, and it's too much. It's too much.
It's clearly too much.
Yeah.
It was a strange kind of combination of events that led to me having 6 books out in 1 year. And they're not all books that I wrote the previous year. Some of them are books that go back a long way. So there were 2 novels I had out last year, one called Bet, as you mentioned, and another one called 20 Trillion Leagues Under the Sea. 20 Trillion Leagues was supposed to be published the year before, in 2013, at the end of 2013, but got pushed back in the publishing schedule, so it came out early 2014. I don't usually have 2 novels out in a year. And then I had a couple of academic titles, because I'm also an academic. I teach at the University of London, and my contract of employment requires me to research. So I have a couple of books about English Romanticism from a scholarly point of view, and a collection of essays, I think it was. And now I'm forgetting what the 6th book was. You see, this is the problem of not writing your own books. You forget exactly what you put your name to.
I can tell you.
Oh, go on then.
It was that How to Get Started Writing Science Fiction, wasn't it?
That's what it was. Very good.
I am that boy in Indonesia.
You really are. I'm not paying you enough. You should ask for a raise. That's right. It was a Get Started in Writing Science Fiction and Fantasy book I wrote.
Yeah.
To teach you how to get started writing in science fiction and fantasy. And actually, all it says, if you open it up, is just get in touch with Mavesh and pay her minimum wage, and she will write all your books for you.
You've given away the secret recipe now. That is the secret sauce, yeah. So you teach literature, as you mentioned, creative writing as well. You write fiction, criticism, and academic research, as you just mentioned. I know you have a family, not of Indonesians, your own family. But please tell me how incredibly organized you are so I can stop wondering if there are 3 of you.
No, there's what I find is I have friends who don't have the same constraints on their time, and they are less productive than I am. So I have a job, and I have a wife and two kids, as you say, and I love them very dearly and spend a lot of time with them. And what that means is when I do get a little bit of time to work, I'm much more focused than I used to be. Whereas people who don't have kids or who don't have to worry about a day job, they often, I think, just the time sort of expands and they take it easy and they read the paper and they have a long leisurely breakfast and they go to the gym and they come back and it's time for lunch and then it's an afternoon nap and then they write for 20 minutes and then they watch a bit of telly and then nothing really gets done. Whereas if I have just an hour free, I go at it like the clappers, as the expression has it. So it's having these constraints upon your time, it forces you to become more organized about what you do.
And you just put down a whole bunch of writers right there.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to hate me. But then a lot of them hate me anyway. And they shouldn't hate me. They could hate the Indonesian. It's not my fault.
Oh,
he's the one who's producing all these books.
I'm really worried about how much trouble this is going to get me into.
I don't know why.
Being the Indonesian. No. Yeah, I don't know why. Why Indonesia? Well, you couldn't have picked on Pakistan because that would be letting the secret out.
Well, that's true, yes. Yeah. I'm trying to steer the spotlight away from you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I do. No, I
so
love
it. Is, I was, yeah, I mean, I was much less productive before we had kids. And now I think one of the tricks to being a writer like this is actually to enjoy writing. And I do know some people who like the idea of being a writer or like the thought that they would have books out, but don't like the actual process of writing. Whereas the secret for me is that that's the part I like. I don't really like having books out particularly, but I do like just sitting down with my computer and a cup of coffee and writing, because I find writing is like reading, only more so. And I love reading, so I find writing's even more immersive. And the best times for me will be if I have a morning free and I start writing and I lose track of time and then I look up and it's noon and I'm desperate for the loo and I have to go and get some lunch because I've been so caught up in what I'm doing.
Now, I love the fact that you've recently done this writing SF guide that you just mentioned. But tell me, did you write any advice, good advice even, that you yourself would never take?
That's a good question. Well, let's not forget, it was you who mentioned it because you could remember it and I couldn't. So I think the first piece of advice I would give any writer is try and keep in mind what it is you're writing or indeed have written. And I had an argument with a friend of mine a few years ago because he read my very first novel, which was called Salt, and he said he liked it except for the man-sized geese that appear in it. And I said, well, now you're just pulling my leg. There were clearly no man-sized geese in my novel. I would never be so stupid as to put man-sized geese in any novel. And then he showed me the page, and indeed I had done, and I'd completely forgotten about it. So try and pay attention, I think, is good advice that I would give any writer. It's a tricky game writing nowadays, I think. It's partly because it's not enough just to write. It's not even enough to write really well. Lots and lots of people are doing that. And in our internet world, the same world that's now allowing you and I to have this conversation miraculously, there are so many people putting work out there online and there's so many calls upon a writer's time and money. You need to do more than just write. You need to somehow put yourself about as well. That means you need to be on social media. You need to be on Twitter and doing all these sorts of things. And some people are very skilled at doing that and build up a following just by doing that. So a piece of advice I would give that I'm not very good at following myself would be to do that, to find, let's say, John Scalzi is a good example. He has a wide following. Because of his blogs and his tweets, people like his voice and what he's doing, and then they seek out his novels. Whereas I find I'm often a bit aggravating in the way I inhabit social media. And I do it, and I'm on Twitter and so on, and I put lots of terrible puns up there. But I also tend to rub people up the wrong way, and I don't know if that's just... I think it's partly because I'm English, and I think that's part of our national character, is to irritate the world.
Tell me how you got started writing science fiction. Is it something you always wrote as a kid, or something you came to much later? Because that's not what you studied.
No, I studied English and classics at undergraduate level, and then I did a PhD on Robert Browning and the classics, Robert Browning, the 19th century English poet. And then I got a job at a university, really primarily to teach Romantic and Victorian literature. But science fiction had always been my my love, if I had thought back in the 1980s when I was getting my PhD, if I had thought I could have got away with getting a PhD in science fiction studies, I might have done that. I think nowadays it's possible. It's a field with more intellectual respectability. But back in the day, I wouldn't have got a job, I think, certainly this side of the Atlantic, if I'd gone around saying, oh, I'd like to teach science fiction. And I'm not denigrating the classics of English literature. I do love the 19th century as well. But I started reading science fiction and fantasy. I started reading Tolkien and Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and Ursula Le Guin. And those are the books that really captured my heart. So I read science fiction obsessively through my youth and through my teenage years. And when I sat down to properly write, I didn't think it was anything else worth even contemplating except science fiction. So I got started after I'd been in my academic job for 6 or 7 years, and after I'd spent a lot of time piddling around, writing bits and pieces that never went anywhere, or starting a novel and then get discouraged after chapter two and giving it up, and thinking, I've got a much better idea, and starting another novel and then getting discouraged and giving it up, and finally realizing that was getting me nowhere, I sat down and said, well, I'm going to sit and write a whole novel. And even if I'm despairing in the middle of it, even if it's clearly the worst thing ever written, I'm going to force myself to complete it, which I think is good advice, which I would offer any writer. You have to finish what you start. So I did that, and I wrote a novel that was awful, very bad indeed, but at least I had written it and I had finished it. So then when I came to write my second novel, the whole process was easier, and the novel itself became much better. And that novel then... I got an agent for that by looking in the writer's and artist's yearbook, and the agent represented it, and it got picked up and it got published. And that was my first novel, which came out, I think, in 1999. Don't know. The 20th century seems such a long time ago now somehow.
It does. Now, you were talking about your love for 19th century literature, which is primarily what you teach, and yet you write science fiction. And it's often stuff set in the future. It's, you know, many brands of science fiction, and you write a lot of that as well. Any interest in writing some of that steampunk or gas lamp fantasy novel kind of stuff that's kind of set in 19th century, well, often in the UK?
Yeah, I wrote a novel called Swiftly, which was set in the 1840s, and which was kind of a steampunky, gaslighty book, I suppose. The premise of the book is that it's set in the universe where Swift's Gulliver's Travels was a true history rather than a fiction. So there really are these Lilliputians and these Brobdingnagian giants and so on. And they've, by the 19th century, they've been recruited into the imperial machinery of Britain and France as it goes. And writing it was an interesting experience because I knew the field very well because of my day job. I didn't have to research very much. It came very easily to me, and that seemed like a good idea. But looking back at it, it's a very strange novel, Swiftly. It's not a regular steampunk book by any means. And that's funny, I haven't really gone back to that. I haven't done that since.
I was going to ask you actually about Swift and about your sort of influences and loves. I mean, I feel that you're one of those writers who sort of wears his influences, his interests, his enjoyment of certain sorts of literature very much on your sleeve. You've written novels that were riffs on or inspired by, as you said, Gulliver's Travels, or by, you know, work by Jules Verne, sometimes pastiche, sometimes just inspired by, say, the idea of something like a locked room mystery. So is this something that comes up again and again on organically without any conscious thought?
Yeah, I do try to write without any conscious thought. I find that if I just empty my head and I don't know, it's like automatic writing. Strange things can come out. I don't know if it's exactly unconscious in that sense. I suppose I feel it's an inevitable part of how books get written nowadays. I'm not sure that I can see a way of writing something entirely free of what we call intertextuality, writing a novel that had no debts at all to the great novels of the past. I think there's a sense in which all writers have to wrestle with their influences and try and twist those into something at least new through rather than instead of their indebtedness to what has gone before. And that's particularly the issue of science fiction, I think. Science fiction fans, in my experience, are extremely well informed about the backlist of the genre, and there's a reason why. Well, I'm not sure if this is the phrase in Pakistan. In this country, people will say, he's never seen Star Wars, as a way of saying he's incredibly culturally uninformed. What do you mean you've never seen Star Wars? Everyone has seen Star Wars. It's a canonical text. It's a requirement that you need to know all the kind of core stories of science fiction, all the tropes and the ideas. So I suppose the writing I do, you're right, that wears it on its sleeve. That I do a sort of Pompidou Centre thing where all the architecture is visible on the outside, because I suppose that seems not only more honest but more kind of eloquent in a way about the modes of intertextuality that shape science fiction. I'm trying to move towards a more polysyllabic set of answers for you.
No, you don't have to do that.
Okay, well, I can go back to monosyllables if you like. In fact, I can just grunt if you like.
I find that interesting that you, for example, use a Star Wars reference, because it's strange to me coming into sort of discovery of what science fiction fandom is, that it exists as this sort of entity by itself. I find it weird because sometimes there is a certain aspect of, oh, you don't know about this or you don't know about that. And my question always is, what is there a course I'm failing?
It can get very kind of sneery and snarky, can't it? It can be a way of looking down upon people because they don't have the same level of knowledge that you do, which is unpleasant.
And it's not a matter of, for me, it's not a matter of level of knowledge. It's a matter of variety. Do you know what I mean? There is a difference in, I'm not judging how much you know, but you're also being judged on what sort of stuff you know. And that, to me, is extremely personal. Everyone's experiences with science fiction or interactions with science fiction or a certain kind of writing are completely independent and completely individual.
Well, that's true. But then fandom is also a community. And what we're talking about are the kind of codes that govern community interaction. And I wouldn't exactly defend it, but I would say that there is a positive side to it as well as a negative and a monolithic side. And the positive side is the side that says what we're doing is we're establishing a canon of crucial science fiction, that if you really love science fiction, you really need to read these books and watch these films. And the positive side of that is making sure that that's a canon that includes women writers and writers of color, writers from all different parts of the world, writers of, you know, difference and diversity, because that's what science fiction is strongest at, that it is the great literature of the other, of otherness as such, and it ought to be more diverse. I'm sounding a bit pious when I say this, but I think the reason I'm mentioning it now is because it's part of the process of canon formation, and because there are culture wars being fought over that in genre at the moment, and there have been for years now, between people who want to keep a kind of fossilized 1950s golden age white male largely American version of science fiction as the core genre, and people who want to open the genre up into all sorts of different voices. I'm clearly in the latter camp.
Yes.
That's why I'm sounding so preachy and pious. But, you know, I'm a dead white male. I'm not exactly dead, not technically dead, but, you know, I'm English, so I'm almost there. So I'm part of the problem as well as hopefully embracing the possibilities. And I try and read as widely as I can. It's funny how, to take, let's say, sexism, it's funny how insidious that is. I've never have thought of myself as a sexist. I would self-identify as a feminist, and my wife's a strong, independent woman, and I've got a daughter, and I hope all the possibilities in the world are available for her, and so on. And then I think it was 3 years ago, I took a look back at my reading, and I discovered that I'd read 80% men and only 20% women. So then I made a conscious decision to alternate my reading. I read a book by a man and a book by a woman. And to begin with, it was an effort. And what the effort was registering was the kind of inertia of sexism, where you don't even notice that you're, in this kind of small way, you're partaking in a larger sexist cultural logic. And then after a while, it becomes second nature. And now it would seem very strange to me if I only read men for a year. That would be an odd exercise.
Now, I know you have an ongoing project to write a short story in each subgenre of science fiction. This seems like fun. Is it fun? What's the funnest story been so far to write?
It is fun. It's fun because it's about unpacking the possibilities of science fiction, which is fantastically diverse in its conceits and its tropes and its settings. And I don't see there's any reason why I'd want to just limit myself to writing space opera or time travel stories or whatever it might be. I think the fun is also, the older I get, the fun becomes as much a formal exercise as an exercise in content or the tropes or approaches. So last year, for instance, I wrote a story called Trademark Bugs, which is in the Reach for Infinity anthology that Jonathan Strahan has edited. And I wrote it in the form of an academic paper. And that was kind of interesting to try and see if it's possible to take something as dry and unappealing as a scholarly paper in the form actually of a paper that might be published in an academic legal journal and still tell a story that was interesting and absorbing and kept the reader's attention. Mind you, I don't know if it did. It may be very dull. But it's interesting to, you know, it's interesting to experiment. Otherwise, I get a bit restless, I think. I was just doing the same thing over and over again. But then I think there's a downside to that as well. I think part of my USP, or so my publisher tells me, is that I write a different sort of book every time. And I think something of that restlessness communicates itself to fandom in a bad way. I think people like to know where they stand with an author, and that if they like their authors to write the same sort of book so that they can go back for more of what they like.
This is exactly what I was going to ask, is that it almost seems like something that would worry a publisher. It's like a wild card. You don't know what's coming next. How are we going to pitch it? How are we going to sell it? Will the people who bought the last book buy the next book? Yet the people at Gollancz seem quite happy with what you're doing.
I've been very lucky with Gollancz, and I'm very happy with my editor, Simon, who's been very supportive. But I think you put your finger on it. I think every time I send him a book or pitch him the idea for a book, you can see a slight panic in his eyes, thinking, oh God, what am I going to do with this one? This is entirely unlike anything else that he's done. And I think there's only so far a publisher can go with the idea of, oh, you know, you should like this author. Everything he does is different. I'm not sure that's commercially very sound.
Is your process much the same for writing, whether it's fiction, criticism, or even your parody novels? I imagine the academic work has far fewer puns. Does that make it even harder to write?
The academic stuff is generally a little bit harder to write, yeah. But the crucial thing with writing is to do it all the time. It's like any exercise. It's like playing the piano. If you practice so many hours every day, then writing, playing a musical instrument, whatever it is, becomes the second nature, and then you can just get across what you want to get across. There are fewer immediate puns, I suppose, in my academic writing. But then academic writing is about interpreting poetry, let's say, or literature. It's exploring the possibilities of different divergent meanings and the way that the text plays, the openness of the text. And that's kind of what puns register. I mean, I wouldn't want to dignify my punning too far. It's clearly a debased and rather lamentable thing. But at its heart, I think it's connecting with that kind of Joycean sense that language is not static and fixed, that it folds many meanings into each of its words. And that's also what I'm doing when I analyse poetry. So the two of the six books I published last year, the two academic titles, one was a monograph on a little known English romantic writer called Walter Savage Landor, and the other was an edition of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Biographia Literaria. And in both those authors, what I found was a real fascination with language in motion, language as something kinetic and creative and expanding. And that's part of the same sensibility, I suppose, that moves me to pun. I don't mention Joyce back then because I think I am Joycean. In fact, in many ways, I think I am, in one way, I think I am better than Joyce, and that's that I have more eyes than he had. So I have binocular vision, whereas he had to wear the eye patch. In all the other respects, of course, I'm much inferior to him. But in that respect, I'm going to hold on to that.
You hold on to that. That's a good thing to hold on to. Yeah.
Also, I'm alive and he's dead, so I feel I'm winning.
He really is a dead white male.
He is, actually. He's even deader than I am.
Now, speaking of punning, which you do a great deal of on Twitter, I have some questions generated from Twitter last night, which I kept asking you not to answer. What's the point of answering it? You're terrible at the suspense business. You know, you really aren't a writer, are you?
I'm ashamed of myself. I'm not, no.
All right, well, the first one was, Aisha asked if there would be a sequel to Riddles of the Hobbit.
Yes, Riddles of the Hobbit, which is a monograph I wrote about J.R.R. Tolkien's Hobbit, and was published 2013. Which was a reading about riddles and riddling, which is akin in a way to punning, actually, riddling. There's a similar energy and a similar fluidity to the way riddles perceive the world. The argument of the book is that the riddling is an ironic rather than a mimetic way of apprehending reality, and that there's much more of that in Tolkien's art than people realise. I don't know if I'm going to write a sequel, though. I hate to disappoint Aisha. She's obviously lovely, but I've written quite a lot about Tolkien academically, and also in, you know, creatively in a way, because he's been a very large influence on me, because I grew up reading The Hobbit over and over again. But the New Year's celebrations, we had a small, we had a couple of friends around on New Year's Eve to our house, and we were talking, and it occurred to me then, last year, the end of 2014, it occurred to me that I hadn't reread The Lord of the Rings in 2014, when I'd done that every year, I think, previously, since I was 9 or 10 years old. And it may be that I've been wrestling for a while with the difficulty of writing critically about something that I'm very personally close to and that I love very much. Those two things are quite hard to do. If you just write from the heart, you end up doing kind of fannish gush. Whereas to write critically, you need to put some distance between yourself and the text you're analysing, and it's quite hard for me to do that. So I've written a number of essays, and I've now written this book. I'm not sure what else I'd say about Tolkien. I don't know, maybe something will occur to me.
Jonah asked what your comfort reading is and what your preferred Beowulf translation is, which I wonder too, because I've just bought the Tolkien one recently.
Yeah, I mean, having just said how much I love Tolkien, I didn't think much of his Beowulf translation. It seemed to be stiff and peculiar and archaic. And he didn't write it to be published. He wrote it as a kind of personal crib, so I'm not criticising him exactly. I think probably it's a slightly sappy answer. I still think the Heaney translation, Seamus Heaney's version, which is quite free in a way, manages to generate some real power, some real heft, but that's partly because it's by Seamus Heaney, I suppose. And what was the other part of the question, which is why...
What's your comfort reading is?
My comfort reading. I do try and read as widely as possible. I think the danger is that I don't want to just read in a rut. I don't want to just read genre. Latterly, over the last 3 or 4 months, I've been reading a great deal of science fiction and fantasy because I'm on judging panel for the Kitschies, the Literary Award, for the best first novel and the best fantasy novel. So we had something like 190 titles submitted to us as judges, and we've had to read those. So I've been reading a great gush of them. And normally, I suppose, fantasy or science fiction would be my comfort reading. But now I'm in the stage where I'm thinking, I'm looking forward to the point where we finally agree a shortlist, and then I can just go and read, I don't know, a 19th century novel or an epic poem or something quite abstruse and rather different. I don't really have a select comfort reading. Just reading itself is nice.
I was going to ask you about the Kitschies. How has that been, judging for them?
It's been a learning curve for me. I've never done this before. I never judged a literary prize before. But they asked me, and I thought, well, yeah, that sounds cool. It went through a phase when it was exciting and I was getting lots of free books, which is obviously nice. And then it got to the point where it was a bit scary because the number of books got larger and larger until I ended up with a Niagara of books coming through the front door from every day. The postman would come with sacks of more books. And then there was a process of digestion. And now I'm at the stage like a huge boa constrictor with 190 books in my belly lying flat on the ground, which is what I'm doing now. It's with a massively distended belly. It's a good job this is only, there isn't a video phone on this, otherwise you'd be thoroughly repelled. And now I'm digesting it and trying to come to some sense of what 2014 was like in terms of science fiction and fantasy. And my general sense, I probably didn't need to read 190 books to get to this conclusion. My general sense is there's an awful lot of very bad stuff published, but then there's also a surprisingly large amount of very good stuff too.
Now, Lavita Dar wants me to ask you about your Lord of the Rings fanfic. I read an article last night that you'd done, an interview done, I think, with Strange Horizons, where you pointed out, I could be wrong, could have been with someone else, you pointed out that all your novels are Lord of the Rings fanfic. How much of that was facetious? I want to believe that it's entirely true.
I think it's Tolkien is just one of those shaping powers on my imagination that I don't think I can ever, I'll never shake him out of there. It's just, he's... I really did read the Middle-earth books obsessively when I was a kid, and in a completely blithe, open way, the way that children, teenagers read. Now that I'm a man, way past 21, I can see all the sort of problematics of Tolkien, particularly where I think race is concerned. That's one of his blind spots. I think also in terms of his women, he's very bad at drawing women. He very rarely puts women characters in. Although I can sort of see more of a justification for that. But in all the other things that he's so powerful at, it's visible, I think, in most of what I write. I think Levy had in mind something particular, that I wrote a short novel, which was called Rings. This is, again, last century. So I'm going to just wave my hand and the general direction of the 20th century. And the idea behind that was The Lord of the Rings tells a story that's set in Middle Earth in a kind of somewhere between an Anglo-Saxon, Old English, medieval, early modern world. So that Gondor is a kind of medieval kingdom and the hobbits are living a kind of early bourgeois life, but all pre-industrial, pre-industrial revolution. And it's written in this slightly archaic manner that Tolkien has, which sort of fits that historical period. So then I thought, well, I wonder what happened to Middle Earth after that. If you fast forward to a kind of 1970s, what would Middle Earth be like with motor cars and so on? And then you could write a novel in a kind of 1970s style, like a sort of John Updike novel or a Philip Roth novel. So I did that. I did a kind of pastiche Philip Roth, John Updike style and wrote a story about an academic historian in a kind of modern post-industrial Middle Earth. And he was an academic historian who was studying the medieval period, which is when the events of The Lord of the Rings happen. And he has a kind of, he has the things that happen to him are the sorts of things that happen in those sorts of 1970s American novels. He has a sort of breakdown and he has an affair and all that sort of stuff. And I quite enjoyed it. And it was quite, worked quite well, I thought. And then I couldn't publish it because the Tolkien estate are very protective of their copyright. It's a very lucrative copyright for them, and they don't want to, they're not going to just let anyone into their park and play. So I was speaking with a publisher, a small press publisher in this country, about publishing it. And he said, well, if you published it, we'd get sued. So perhaps if you took out all the specific Tolkien references and made it just non-specific, a sort of fantasy realm and so on. And I was thinking about doing that, and then I thought that just took all the point out of the novel, the specificity. So it's languished, unpublished. I'll put it in the large vault, which we have at my castle in Berkshire, where I live. And maybe 100 years after I'm dead, they'll bring it out and publish it, and it will be acclaimed the great missing masterpiece of 20th century literature. I mean, there's a serious point here, which is that there's something quite restrictive about the way copyright operates now, it seems to me. I don't know if this is too old a debate now, that people like Cory Doctorow have been arguing this for a long time, that the copyright laws, which are supposed to be there really to protect the intellectual property of ordinary people like you or like me, are largely put at the service of giant corporations so that Disney, say, are able to still generate large quantities of money out of material like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck that should have come out of copyright many years ago, in the 90s, I think.
You mentioned your vault. Is it anywhere near as good as Prince's in Paisley Park?
I actually bought that vault from Prince. He's a good friend of mine. So he said, do you need the vault anymore? He said, no, please take it, Adam. So I had it shipped over on a trireme across the Atlantic, and I've reinstalled. I wish I had a vault. Wouldn't it be great to have a vault?
It would be great to have a vault.
I live in a completely ordinary English house in Berkshire.
Right towards the end of the podcast, you mentioned we're going to go back full circle. You mentioned the book, the new novel from this year. Can you tell us a little bit about it, when it's out, what it's about?
Well, I can. I am still writing it, though, so I'm still kind of discovering what it's about. What I like to do when I write is, I know there are writers who like to plan out every last little detail before they start the process of writing, and I've tried doing that, and I think it leads to a sort of under-energized, rather by the numbers airless, final product. On the other hand, if I just start writing with no idea where I'm going, then everything will splurge and splay all over the place. So what I like to do is, I have a sense of the main concept of the book, the main characters, and I know where the book's story is going. And I know the kind of key points I want to get to on the way. And then I write to find my way to those key points. And then when I've written the whole thing, I can take a look at it and see if it all works. So at the moment, it's a novel that's going to be quite a bit longer than my usual novels, I think. I'm going to make it sound as unappealing as possible to any potential readers. It's really a novel about, the premise is, what if the philosophy of Immanuel Kant is true, if it could be objectively verified, what consequences might there then be? And it sounds quite abstruse, and actually it's working out that way. There's quite a lot of the novel is characters sitting in chairs having detailed conversations about Kant's transcendental categories with one another, which I think makes for a bracing change from the action-led excitement of most stories. I think the public might be ready for an incredibly dry, tedious, philosophical novel, or then again, perhaps not. Maybe when I come to revise it, I shall cut down on the dry, tedious academic disquisitions and put a little bit more action and excitement in, because it is quite an exciting idea, I discover. If Kant is right, that space and time are not objective features of the universe, but are the way our mind structures our perceptions, then it ought to be possible to alter space and time without having to build huge rockets or vast machines. We ought to be able to travel to distant stars or indeed go back in time, if Kant is right. So that's the good thing about science fiction. It gives you a space in which you can explore the possibilities of this.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for doing the podcast with me today.
Thank you, Bhavesh. It was my pleasure. It was really, I really enjoyed that.
And I hope that when the new book is out, we'll have a long, detailed discussion about philosophy.
I look forward to that as well, yes.